This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Patreon supporters. Thanks, guys. Check out the new goal that's on the top of the page at the left. If you hit that goal, you will unlock a book review. That and other choice extras at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And speaking of extras, please stay tuned for a big content announcement during the episode, which starts right now.
And he texts me back saying, "Hi, Tracy, please call me urgently on this number, Chris." And in brackets, he wrote, "Hamish's brother-in-law." And I stopped and I called him and I said, "Chris, who the fuck is Hamish?"
It's taking all my strength to resist making a throw another con on the Barbie joke, so why fight it, right? But here's the point. We are talking about tragedy vampires on today's episode, starting with the latest limited series from The Australian, Who the Hell is Hamish? Later, we'll return to 2012 and 9/11 with Angelo Guglielmo's documentary on 9/11 survivor faker Tanya Head, The Woman Who Wasn't There. All this and a soft launch on The Blotter Presents, episode 97. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, home of the creakiest desk chair in the world. Sorry, guys. Also, we talk about how true crime is told and sold. And I'm joined once again by Eve Beatty, who remains unrelated to the Zodiac. Hello, Eve.
Well, Sarah, I'll tell you, I will be helping clean out the garage at my parents' home this summer. So who knows? I might come up with some sort of evidence. We'll see.
Well, please do keep us posted. I am, as ever with quote updates on this case, not super optimistic, but I guess you just never know. All right. Before we get into our main topics today, Eve and I are thrilled to announce the arrival of the Blotter Presents newsletter, Best Evidence. Best Evidence delivers true crime reviews, analysis, and pertinent headlines to your email inbox every single weekday. It's like the Blotter Briefs, but textier. This past week, we've had some book reviews. We are going to be fantasy casting American crime story JonBenet. Please note, this is not an actual thing. It's just what we're doing. We're going to look at upcoming series on the Yorkshire Ripper and at the last season of Homicide Hunter. Basically, we are winnowing down your true crime to-do lists because there's really a lot out there. Maybe you've heard. You can find Best Evidence at blotterpresents.substack.com. That's blotterpresents.substack.com. There will be a link in the show notes. And I should mention that gift subscriptions are available, so you can give the gift of true crime review to dads and grads and anyone else. Publisher Eve Beatty, anything else that listeners should know about Best Evidence?
Well, I mean, I think that the reason that I was excited about doing this with you, Sarah, besides the fact that, you know, you're great to work with and all the stuff that everybody already knows, is that there's like you said, there's so much stuff out there. And I think it, you know, everybody I talk to now is so interested in true crime. They want some sort of guidance, and there's no reason that they should just be stuck watching some inferior sort of, you know, whatever, old episodes of America's Most Wanted or something like that, when there's so much great stuff out there. But how do you find it? What are you going to do? Just keep posting things to Facebook like, "Hey guys, what should I watch?" That's what we're here to solve.
Indeed. Once again, that's blotterpresents.substack.com, and you can always email us with questions and suggestions at editorial@the-blotter.com. Speaking of questions, our most wanted topic is titled with one. We are talking about the podcast Who the Hell is Hamish? Here's the case file from The Australian's landing page for the podcast. This podcast does come to you from The Australian magazine. Quote, "He was born Hamish Watson, a surfy dude from Sydney, but he could morph into whatever you needed him to be. Hamish is due to be sentenced to jail in early 2019 for swindling a handful of victims out of more than $7 million. But these crimes are just the final pages in a resume too thick to staple. For decades, he's duped victims in the US, Canada, Britain, Hong Kong, and Australia. How did he do it? How did he evade authorities around the world for so long? And what's he done with all those tens of millions of dollars he stole? I believe that there was a sentencing update fairly recently, which you covered in Best Evidence, to wit, his attorneys are claiming that he has autism and therefore is not responsible. Is that the gist?
Well, so what they've said is that he needs to undergo psychiatric evaluation. He's already admitted to the crimes. He's already, you know, so therefore he has already been arguably convicted. But now they're sort of going back on all of it and saying, oh, well, you know, they are characterizing autism as a mental disorder. That is not my characterization. This is the characterization of his attorneys. And that therefore he needs a psychiatric evaluation, which at the time they said in February would take about 6 weeks. So his final sentencing, you know, hearing was supposed to have already happened, but now they're going to have another hearing in sort of June to present their evidence from the experts to see if there's a reason that he should get out of it. But it's, I think, pretty obvious that, you know, someone's decided they don't want to go to jail.
Yeah, exactly. And is going to rake the non-neurotypical over the coals in the course of doing that. I forget who came up with this term. It may have been John Douglas, who was talking about how some people, you know, will try to get out of this sort of thing by saying that they have a personality disorder or a mood disorder. And he calls this a character disorder. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's not a finding that means you're not responsible. Anyway, this podcast began earlier in the year or end of last year. I think it was actually February of this year that it started. And they have really good access to his various marks. Does he just have the one wife? I haven't got to the end yet.
No, I haven't gotten to the end yet, but I think that we have heard from one wife and one girlfriend, and I'm sort of at the halfway point.
Mm, same. They were not able to speak to his birth family. They reached out to them and the family declined to participate, despite extremely outlandish stories that he told to various associates about the deaths of his family and his childhood. His parents and siblings are still living, and evidently it was really a rather straight ahead childhood. But I liked that. I really like the structuring of this. First of all, they sort of begin at the end, and they're fairly, it's hosted by Greg Baerup, and he's quite open about the fact that they're, you know, beginning at the end. And then it kind of goes backward in the way of American Crime Story, Assassination of Gianni Versace, where you're sort of located at the end, and then you're going back and up, and then further back and up. And it's an interesting way to do it that isn't necessarily, it might not work for all stories, but I think it works for this one. What did you think?
Yeah, well, especially, like, you know, when you go into the first episode and they're talking about some guy named Max and this perfect love story and how Hamish came in and destroyed it. And, you know, spoiler, midway through, you realize that Max is actually Hamish. And by Hamish destroying it, it's just like, well, Hamish is an asshole and he has fake names. But yeah, I think that there's a sort of I wish I knew more about art so I could have the term for you. The effect of sort of layering brushstroke over brushstroke to create a more beautiful picture is something that they're doing here. I think that, you know, when you're in the car, if you try to binge it all at once, you're going to sort of feel buried by details. But if you sort of force yourself to pace yourself and maybe listen to an episode a day or whatever, which is what I ended up sort of trying to do, I feel like it has sort of more impact when you hear the different sort of lies and the different ways he played and manipulated his victims, who, in retrospect, or especially, you know, I think for members of the audience who are so familiar with how this stuff works, seems so clear. But when you listen to the episodes more slowly, you start to understand how people could have been sucked in by this guy.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up that it really is quite a dense presentation, because I think that that reflects how Hamish worked his dark magic. Let's listen to a clip. I believe this is Tracy, who is the girlfriend that we, yeah, at the end, who we hear from in the beginning.
You know, it was very detailed. And yes, whilst I was interested, it was in such detail that, you know, it's hard to keep up sometimes, in a way that, yes, you could continue to ask questions, but, you know, he did have really big stories and they went on for a long time. And, you know, they, yes, it seemed, it was interesting to me, but completely unfamiliar.
And I think that's a very good encapsulation of how some cons work. I mean, they say that you should just keep your lives as simple as possible, but for a guy like this, maybe the real magic is in just wearing people down with lengthy, extremely densely embroidered stories. And you do see a similar, although not, I mean, it's not dull, but this is a very densely edited property. Maybe I'm just used to like Wondery, where there's kind of a lot of like interstitial music and ads and whatnot. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but this is very different. There's no ad breaks. There's not a whole lot of like transitional sound cues. It's just like a very tightly edited, not palimpsest, but I don't know the word. I don't know the word we're looking for either, but it's very close textured, as Mary Berry would say on Bake Off.
I feel like where they sort of add the, you know, the razzmatazz or whatever is the host, Greg Baraup, who is a journalist, but he doesn't approach with this, with the sort of the traditional American unbiased journalism sort of a thing. He does definitely approaches it more with a sort of a old school true crime property, like, and now Hamish's shenanigans took a new, you know, like, there is definitely no allegeds. There's no, according to prosecutors, it's like, oh my God.
You're right.
And then Hamish was doing this. You guys won't believe what's coming up next. I mean, I'm Americanizing it, but Greg definitely puts, I won't say a tabloidy spin, because I mean, it's all legit, but there is that sort of like coming up next. And I think that that's sort of where the spice is.
For sure. They also have a good ear, he and the production team, for when he should be doing a little explainer in the middle and when he should really be letting tape run of Hamish's victims, associates, and so on. Yeah. And we'll get to one of his explainers in a bit. But first, I pulled a clip of one of his, this may be Tracy again, actually, talking about his extremely over-embroidered story of being present at 9/11, since it ties into our cold case. So here's clip three.
He was talking in detail about all the people that he had worked with, who worked on different levels, what levels they worked on, what departments of businesses they worked for, you know, so much detail. And yeah, that was the cup of tea. And I remember at the end he said, bloody hell, we've spoken a lot about me today. Oh, you know, I haven't asked you any questions. And it seemed really authentic. And I said, oh, that's okay. I mean, God, that's such a huge thing. Like, that's an incredible story. And what he did say is that afterwards, the kind of the post-traumatic stress of it and being there is, you know, he took 3 years off working. And he went to Italy and raced pro triathlon. And that was his time off. And he just, didn't want to work for that period of time. And he said a lot of the guys in the industry did the same.
That's not a thing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Hamish. That's not a thing. But for a guy like this to leverage an occasion like that to explain unusual behavior, gaps in his resume, to sort of put you on the back foot in terms of questioning anything that he says, because it might be considered intruding on his grief or trauma. I mean, that he wasn't the only one. Clearly, that he and Tanya Head were leveraging it for different reasons, but I just found it both sort of grody. Like, there's kind of no other word for it. Like, it's just kind of a grimy thing to do, but also clever. And this is something that the podcast does well, is like just hang a lantern on how he does what he does to put us on the side of his victims more, because it sometimes can feel a little bit during any account of a con or a con artist's, you know, travels with the destruction left in his wake, it's hard to give these accountings and not seem a little judgy, even by accident. And
sure.
Who the Hell Is Hamish is very good at reminding you, like, these are professionals and this is what they do. And most people's pattern recognition lets them function.
Well, I think, you know, the 9/11 thing, it's, you know, it's so interesting to me. It's what it makes me think of is like when you watch a vampire show and how like every vampire like go-to line is like, yeah, so I was there at the crucifixion or something. If everyone, you know, and yeah. And I feel like maybe this was like a joke on maybe True Blood or something like that. I don't know, where someone said like if every vampire who said they were at the crucifixion was there, you know, that it would have been like, you know, the entire country would have been covered in vampires, or, you know, or like the police's like first like a U.S. sort of tour. If everyone had been there, like there wouldn't have been any room at the Holiday Inns. And I feel like we're seeing more and more of this at certain levels with 9/11. I know anecdotally, I live in San Francisco, I'm hearing more and more about people who are presenting things to VCs and building into part of their narrative their relationship to 9/11, whether it's legitimate or not. And I have to say that all of this stuff where we're hearing about the elaborate, lengthy stories, and I think that there have been some couple other clips where women he's been involved with, when they've sort of asked about his work as in hedge funds or whatever else, and he speaks at great length, it so reminds me of sort of scammy Silicon Valley people, both men and women, Theranos being a great example of that, where you bury people in details, you blind them with science. The sort of the small level con is the IT person at your work who refuses to tell you how to do things, so they're insured a job. But, you know, I think that this tactic is something we're going to see more and more, like, you know, as time goes on, people who are just trying to, like, you know, make you feel stupid so you don't ask questions. And then the cherry on the top is, and there's also tragedy.
Mm. Yeah. So you don't ask questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's, we'll definitely see this in the cold case segment, but I think it's a very effective strategy. And the fact is, like, I don't love admitting this, but part of my attraction to stories like this, like Theranos, like, what's his name? Abagnale, like art forgers, and I'm just like, so this is really like a psychological proposition that involves
JT LeRoy.
Like
that's my, you know, no one's going to ask what JT LeRoy, the pretend writer who detailed this childhood of sexual abuse and trauma. No one's going to be like, so did anyone really rape you? You know? Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm always fascinated by how, like, it's not like I'm gathering information to do it myself, except maybe on some level I am. Like, I just don't, I never get away with anything. They'll like put that on my tombstone. Like, even cutting school, never got away with it. So it's really not possible for me to pursue a life of confidence game crime. But it is super interesting to me to look at the nuts and bolts of a con and how much of it, like, all you have to do is sort of plant the seed, and then your mark kind of does all the watering and deadheading of dead branches themselves, and you're just kind of like, all right, great. Like, what's her face? Anna Sorokin. I mean, she just had to create the illusion for one person, and then it kind of self-sustained. So I'm fascinated by that, and I think this podcast has an excellent, like, ear for why we listen to and read and consume stories about cons. That it's, you know, it's not always like, I would like to see justice done for this, you know, to this flim-flammer. It's partly that, but it's also, we want to know how this works, not just to protect ourselves, but to know how it works so that we can sort of wool gather and have fantasies about, you know, having a gazillion disguises and being Sneaky Pete. Anyway, in clip four, Greg Baripp is describing what's called the put up, which is basically like how Hamish would set up these Ponzi relationships that were not aware that they were integrated with each other. This is a bit of a long clip, but I think it's really well done. And here's clip four.
How do you steal tens of millions of dollars without drawing any real attention from the law? Well, this is Hamish's system. First, you need to find some victims.
I was introduced to Hamish by
a friend, a colleague, a fellow surfer bobbing out beyond the break at Bondi. It could be a faith healer or a car salesman. The vital part here is that the victims were sold on investing with Hamish by people they trusted. To one woman who gave him her divorce settlement, he was simply
Hamish, that was it. He never gave me his surname.
It may seem mind-boggling, but all these people were convinced that Hamish was making them money. It's how a pyramid scheme works. The next step was the first meeting where people felt they were falling in with
a very busy, very successful investor.
The key here was that Hamish deployed reverse psychology. He didn't ask for much, but said,
don't give me all your money, just give me a portion of your money and, you know, we'll go slowly and when you're comfortable, we'll see how we go, whether or not we can work with each other, whether we like each other and
then, a month later, he'd give you back some of your money, the supposed profits from an incredibly lucrative deal he'd done. Most victims were simply satisfied with seeing paper returns on falsified statements, but many were given real money, the fat profits from their first investment with Hamish.
As seen in The Sting and many other places, it's like a one-man big store. I mean, and the way that this is edited is really something, that he's going back and forth between his own description and the tape that he has with Marks. And the narration speeds up. It's very dense. There's that percussion that's happening in the background that sort of raises the aural stakes. It's really well done. Very cleverly done.
Yeah, it made me wish I had a road trip so I could, you know, which I know I just said don't marathon it, but I would stay in the car to listen to the rest of an episode, because even though there was so much, I still felt a little addicted.
Yeah, same. I actually was in the car listening to this yesterday and wound up sort of in my parents' driveway idling. My mom's at the back door like, are you going to get out? I'm like, nope. Like, two more minutes. I absolutely recommend this podcast. I will be finishing it toot sweet the next time that I'm in the car. I think it's 8 episodes total. And it's just really smartly done. There's no like dull bits so far. Like, sometimes you have a podcast like this that podcasts seem to be allergic to being an odd number of episodes in a season. I don't know if you've noticed this, but there hasn't been that like third or fifth episode that you're like, now you're just, you know, dog paddling so you can fill it out until the end. There hasn't been that yet. I am halfway through. Each episode is about half an hour, 40 minutes, and it's densely done, but it's, I mean, perfect commute length for a lot of people, or perfect going for a run length. I think it's really great. It's very processy. But it's not too, you know, it's not too much of that. It's a good, there's good depth to it. So yeah, I really like it. I'm excited that I finally got around to listening to it.
Oh yeah. And I am already looking forward to like whatever film or Lifetime or whatever adaptation ends up with this, because I feel like there are a lot of interesting ways they could go, and it has a lot more potential, I think, to be interesting and fun than something that's maybe a little more straightforward and quote unquote trashy like Dirty John.
Mm. Well, I was actually going to ask about that. How do you think that this compares to Dirty John, like just in terms of either on its own merits or like its adaptability for, you know, a prestige like series on Bravo with a dream cast?
Well, I think, you know, the thing with Dirty John is that as part of the nature of the crime itself, so much of it seemed to be about being in sexual thrall to, you know, to the con artist, right? And that's not a factor with Hamish, that in fact, and I don't know if you've gotten to this point yet, that Hamish wasn't into sex, and sex with him was sort of a cold and impersonal. There's something about that that's really interesting to me, because I think that that meant that he had to rely on other things. And I think that that is what makes it potentially more interesting as an adaptation, because you're not reliant on just like, you know, yeah, I'd happily get conned by Eric Bana too. I mean, I could get conned with him all day long, especially, you know, like the Eric Bana from the documentary about the car. But any, I'd really accept any Eric Bana any day of the week. But with something like Hamish, where we hear that there are times when he's super out of shape and he doesn't want to do it, I think there's just so much more really interesting character-y stuff to hoe there that in the right hands, it could be really terrific.
Oh, agree. And I also think that this is a more sort of like classic example of, you know, when you say that someone's a con, that's short for confidence. And the confidence here is much less, as you said, about sexual thrall and much more about emotional support. And giving, particularly in the case of his wife and then later the girlfriend, like giving these women confidence in themselves, and then sort of slowly, you know, doing the take back. So that is a really interesting aspect of it. And as well, you have so many different options, I think, in terms of the casting, because could be such a, like, even with the very distinctive bright blonde dye job, this was someone who was fairly not forgettable looking, but just like, you know, how are you going to describe this person to law enforcement?
He's not a Hemsworth, you know, so
yeah.
Like, he's just, but that's the thing, is there is such a multitude of great Australian actors out there, and it would be nice to hear them speaking in their own voice that, I mean, if I were doing this, I wouldn't go for the obvious and pick the oldest Hemsworth, the guy from Westworld. I would pick, you know, the zillions of other great actors that are out there who are of middle age and would be willing to put on a little weight, and by which I don't mean the fake Thor costume from Avengers Endgame.
Agree. I'm trying to remember the guy's name who was in the original Animal Kingdom movie.
Oh, played Pope, right.
Mendelsohn. Yeah. Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who was so good and absolutely has that, like, not changeable face, but he's just like average white band guy.
No, I do think he's changeable. He is one of those people. He's got a Gary Oldman-like quality where he disappears into roles. That's a great call, Sarah. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, unless Gary Oldman decides that he wants this role, which I'm not going to hate that either, I got to tell you. Guy Pearce? Too much?
Too thin.
Too toothy. Yeah.
Too, yeah.
All right. Speaking of Too Toothy, we have one last clip that ends on the great gleaming smile that let Hamish put this over. Here's clip five.
The repayments Victim A saw as the profits on an investment were actually just the savings that Victim B had passed on to Hamish 2 years later. Then there's a third victim who invested $1 million with Hamish, some of which was used to keep the wolves at bay from Victim B's door. Hamish shuffled money back and forth between unwitting hosts in this fashion, skimming a healthy cream off the top to fund his own extravagant lifestyle. And as with any parasite, Hamish needed to keep his hosts alive, but it couldn't last forever. Every few years he'd simply disappear until the dust had settled. The victims would report it to the police. The cops would say it's a commercial dispute. He'd resurface somewhere else, Canada, London, Bluey's Beach, Bondi, under a new guise, a new name, and a great gleaming smile.
I pulled this clip for a couple of reasons. One, because it explains why he continued to elude law enforcement, basically because law enforcement would be like, this is not our problem. Take it to civil section, I guess. And also because this little piano tinkling that you hear in the background is very evocative of like what I imagine as a hotel bar that he's in, pretending to eat peanuts and watch CNN and waiting for someone to exploit to come along. And it's
That's very
effective unconscious detail if it was intended. And even if it wasn't, take the W.
What I imagined was that very beginning of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, where the broom is starting to sort of pop up before it takes over and makes Mickey Mouse's life a living hell. But I think that, you know, sort of the other thing that's important to remind people of here in, that the show's reminding people of is that, because I think that everyone's like, well, why didn't they catch this guy? Why didn't they do anything? And it's like, Hamish is really only a few steps from that kind of sketchball, scammy friend of yours from college who maybe has skips out on checks early and, you know, has like moved out of a lot of apartments real fast. And, you know, when you listen to this show, you'll hear like, well, he had this friend or he was still in touch with his parents, but they couldn't come to his wedding because his mom had just had cataract surgery and stuff like these. He has, unlike so many con artists, there are people who have been in his life for a while who remained in his life and just sort of knew he was a scammer. And I think a large part of it is because by and large, the money that was given to him was freely given to him. And so there wasn't a lot that anybody could do until, everyone sort of got together and figured this out. But people knew. People knew he was sort of a schemey weirdo. They just didn't really do anything. And, like, you know, you say, Sarah, that you do it because maybe you imagine what it would like to be a con artist. Well, that sounds very stressful to me. I don't want to do that. But
yeah.
When I listen to this, I sort of think, like, you know, how different is this from what I see here, you know, with various sort of shell games and, you know, VC-based Ponzi schemes, essential Ponzi schemes in San Francisco. How is this different than people who sort of have vaporware and go and tell people we're eventually going to have this thing, now give us $5 million and we're going to, you know, expense account every meal until then? Like, I always feel the reason I like these shows is because I see the echo of real non-fantastical life in them, and it helps me be more skeptical about everything.
Well, I mean, the line between what you're describing and what has been formally criminalized is cobweb thin, obviously. But the other thing is, like, I think that many cons rely on victims and marks being too either embarrassed to report it or too practical to bother.
Yep.
Because once the money's gone, like, that sort of in the victim's position, that would sort of be my primary concern, is that it's like, well, you know, you could sue him to death, but he's physically not going to appear. And the money has been spent on Botox. Cool. So it's like, you know, how long am I going to pursue this when I have to pay a lawyer to go after money that's already gone? So, yeah, that's definitely understandable. So, yeah. All right. Let's move on to the cold case. But once again, that's Who the Hell is Hamish? It's available wherever you download podcasts. You can also listen to it on The Australian's website. They have, if you are a subscriber to The Australian, some extras. And if you are a subscriber to Best Evidence, you will be reading some extras. We'll bring you updates, if there are any, on Hamish's sentencing and many other con-related stories. Cons, imposters, identity thieves. It's one of our favorite topics. Moving on. To the woman who wasn't there, you can watch this film, which comes in at a terse 64 minutes on iTunes and Amazon. It used to be on Netflix, and it may be back there at some point. Here's the case file as written for the IMDb by the director. Quote, a psychological suspense thriller about the World Trade Center Survivors Network and their former president, Tanya Head. After meeting director Angelo J. Guglielmo Jr., Head commissioned a documentary based on her work with the Survivors Network. Filming began, and the world's most famous 9/11 survivor told her story with spellbinding intensity. There was only one problem. Tanya Head was never in the Twin Towers, and her epic story of grief was a complete fabrication. I have seen this movie a few times now. It's right up there with The Imposter about Frederick Bourdain as one of my sort of go-to, like, I find it almost not soothing, but like it's so well done. And this kind of story is so appealing to me and compelling to me that I've watched both of those several times. I don't think I was aware until I was pulling this for the case file that he had started out to make this documentary about her and the Survivors Network, because that part of it is not really in the documentary. Like, there's no framing in the documentary that indicates that this story started out as one thing and then turned into, like, the unmasking of the original subject. Were you aware that that was the initial log line of the movie?
Well, when I pulled sort of the information on this guy to see what he had done since I think this is from 2011, I saw that the only other thing he had done was a documentary prior to this about volunteers following 9/11. And
I saw
so
that
I
too.
Yeah, so I was sort of like, huh, that's interesting. And then, like, I found, I don't know, like on some, like, you know, site somewhere, like a very brief sort of like 2-line interview with him where he's like, yeah, he had talked to Tanya about this and he'd gotten footage with her on this. And then, you know, when I think it was David Dunlap, you know, sort of unmasked her in the Times, he realized he had sort of this other story that he could tell. But these are the only things that this director has, you know, done according to his resume and everything else. So I don't know what he's up to these days.
Well, and it comes from Meredith Vieira's production company. Which, all right, go ahead, yeah. MV. But it's such a, that seems like it would be, that would be in the documentary more, which, like, it's a documentary. It's not really a psychological thriller. It's a pantsing of Tanya. But the fact is, like, there is a lot of footage of her. There is a lot of interview footage of her that does not seem to be like file footage, or like there's no chyron that says it's from ABC. Like, I think that Guglielmo shot her for this initial project, and then, you know, then the scales fell from everyone's eyes. But that's just a bit strange to me. Like, this I like this film, but there's something about it. There's something about it that just suggests, like, more potential at a longer runtime. Would you agree with that? Like, leaving aside that this aspect of what was not in it, did you feel like there were more things that should have been in it that were not?
Well, I do think, I mean, I think that people who haven't read the logline deserve an explanation for how they got all this footage from this woman who was a scammer. And I'm certainly not arguing that this should be the catfish movie. even though it very easily could have been, right? I mean, this, you know, this guy could have made himself the central figure on it and been like, ah, oh, so I was working on this one thing and I talked to her and realized all this. I don't think we need that. I don't think that we need him to, you know, to Nev himself. But I do think that a little bit of an explanation, we started talking to Tanya and these other people because of this, and this is what we realized when we saw this. A narrative that was structured a little differently, as opposed to easily, I think it's like 25 minutes before we get any sort of hint other than the title of the film that this was all fake.
Yeah. And that, you know, I mean, there's also the fact that this all began online, which is, I guess, a value neutral statement, except it isn't. And I think that you have to get more into what it is about an online community that allows this kind of thing to go on for a while. Like Tanya had seemed to have no compunction about or apprehension about taking it into meat space, as we used to say once upon a time. So maybe he just decided that wasn't a narrative line that was worth going, that was worth following. But I think it's significant. Maybe when you're a hammer.com, everything looks like a nail.com, but that this support group began online, where it's much easier to be who you're not, or not be who you are, which I think is really at the center of it for this woman. He didn't really pursue that.
Well, that it was sort of like I'm not saying you need to go into the nitty gritty of like how a Yahoo group works. Even though I was like, oh, yeah, Yahoo groups,
fact,
all
please
right.
Don't. I know. Oh, that B-roll. But, I was like, oof, yeah.
But still, like, this is 2011. It's been long enough since Yahoo groups were a thing and boards were a thing or whatever, that a little bit of explanation on how people made connections before there was Facebook, people made connections this way and this is how it worked and it was like this. Because by 2011, Facebook was sort of like, you know, had killed Yahoo groups and all those other things, right? So explaining to people that this is how people came together, you know, across borders in this time back then, I think would have been useful, because that, if nothing else, would give a little more sort of a reason why there would be this intensity of bond between Tanya and people like Linda, where it doesn't seem like, you know, this was obviously built out of something above and beyond, you know, the sort of their relationship from face to face, and being like, this is something that was forged online and then went into IRL, I think would have been important to explain why people were following her and not questioning her for as long as they did.
Well, and also the fact that for people who were and were not anywhere nearby, 9/11 was something that was like occurring in real time via online for a lot of people. For instance, on the Television Without Pity boards, there was like a whole thread where people are like, well, it's a good thing Sayers, that's me, for listeners who are not familiar with my two decades of back catalog. Thank goodness that she is in Toronto. And it's like, well, actually, I was five blocks away at a meeting, like on a breakfast panel. And people are like, well, wait, like, how are you? What's going on? How are you going to get back to Toronto? Like, this was how information was being exchanged. And this is also how someone who wanted to grab the coattail of this tragedy would learn how it was being spoken about by people who had been there. And I don't think that's irrelevant to this case, because she, you know, she put on people who had been present and had that dust in their hair for years. But, you know, nobody thinks that that's going to be something that someone does. Here's clip six.
We started as an online peer support group where you could go into a Yahoo group and connect to other survivors 24 hours a day. So one day you were having a bad day and you would post it online, and within 30 minutes, you get 40 replies of people saying, I know what you feel. you know, it's okay to have those feelings. I'm here for you. Just call me anything you need.
Many people were having economic problems, health problems, just a lot of that sense of parallel reality that people were heavily living through, and I think to a large degree still do. And I think it was just being with other people and talking about this stuff helped.
I had many conversations with Tanya, just one-on-one conversations, where she gave me a lot of support, like nobody else had.
So, yeah, that's, I mean, this is how that kind of con works, in part. Number one, it's online, where people are feeling a little more free and not as observant of various boundaries, their own and other people's. And two, that she is being supportive and inserting herself into this trauma processing that way. So, but I also think that she's not, I would not characterize Tanya Head as all that, I don't know what the word is, not venal, but I think that her plan was not so much a plan necessarily compared with Hamish. I don't know if you agree.
It seems, well, I think, you know, Hamish wanted to make money, and I think that was a big part of it. Like, I'm certainly not trying to sort of negate Tanya's personal responsibility, but this almost, like, seems like emotional Munchausen's.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, as opposed to, like, she didn't have a plan, because she said things, you know, she fabricated this whole relationship, and I know that we're going to cover this in, you know, clip 8, but she fabricated this whole relationship that was easily debunked just by Googling this guy's name. She fabricated this whole rescue story that involved a real person whose family, you know, was very engaged in, you know, sort of following his memory. These were all, she built a story that was easy to take apart. And in my opinion, what happened is that she repeated it so much in her online persona that she began to believe it. So in real life, when she, you know, would make these statements, she wasn't like Hamish or like you or I, if we were just trying to keep a lie going. She didn't have it in her head, well, you know, I have to do this to make this part of the lie believable. She was just saying stuff. She was just playing this role so fully that she didn't realize that she was playing a role in a lot of the time.
I have to eventually just go online and nail down this reference in psychology, because I make reference to it all the time and I don't know what it's called. It's like the asymptotes of lie size or something like that. Mm-hmm. I like, somebody at me with this information, listeners. I know one of you knows what I'm talking about. That it's the principle that either you have to, it's similar to the uncanny valley, but with bullshitting. So either you have to like lie very little, like only change a couple of details so you don't trip yourself up, like teeny little lies that you can get away with, or you have to go so big that nobody would think to check it, because who is going to lie about their arm almost being severed?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's easy to check with your eyeballs, which, you know, someone did, and he says as much, like the former head of the Survivors Network, who was forced out by Tanya. So one wonders if she didn't have a plan for this con. That, you know, one of the planks in the, you know, in the platform being, I'm just going to tell these massive whoppers because nobody's going to check it. Like, they seem too big to fail, these lies. And also, I'm going to leverage personal relationships against someone who's already in power. Like, I mean, I don't know. Like, she vanished, and I don't think we'll ever get any answers out of her. But in our next clip, they talk a little bit about this concept, and how the hugeness of her trauma and grief sold the fact that she'd suffered it at all. Here's clip 7.
My story was so insignificant to what she went through that my first reaction writing to her was, that's horrible and I don't belong in this group. And a lot of people wrote that, and she was very supportive, saying, no, you do. You know, what we all went through is equally important.
She was fabulous. Here's this person who went through so much that who in the world could possibly survive this? Yet she's a survivor. Here she is. She's a survivor.
I think you find that by talking to other people and helping others getting involved, it helps carry your own burden. And I think that's how you mask it. You kind of hide your pain by getting involved helping others.
You also collect critical details that help you reinforce the foundations of your own tower of horseshit. Not for nothing. The film is interesting because I think it does have a lot of compassion for her. And like pity for her. And I think she is somewhat pitiable, but this is, not how her former colleagues in the Survivors Network feel about it at this point, possibly because I think in some cases they were interviewed like 20 minutes after after reading this article. But the woman who wasn't there, I would have liked another 10 minutes, not in any one spot, but just like aggregate over the runtime of the movie, just sort of taking a little bit more of a position, not on why she did what she did, because I think there are a lot of reasons and those are fairly well covered and you don't need to hold my hand on that, but on whether she really did have a conscious order of operations in what she was trying to do with this, or if it just started as her being bored and lonely, going into a Yahoo group, making up some shit about being present, and then it just snowballed on her. My feeling is that, A, you're correct that she told some of these lies so many times that she did come to believe them, and they did become, you know, very natural to her, but also that some of these details are like, they're so cheesy that they're almost unbelievable, and that's what sells it, particularly with the Dave story. Did you find that at all?
Well, the Dave story, and maybe we should listen to the clip first, because I have some specific thoughts on what you pulled here.
All right, here's clip 8.
And there was Dave standing in the middle of a circle of orchids. And the next morning, we started calling all our friends and families, telling them we had gotten married. Not married, but married.
I just love that little sound at the end. Boo. Like, okay. Got it.
And so this story and a lot of the, the sort of the recreations and the flashbacks, I should point out, are done in this absolutely gorgeous animated style. I mean, it just, how it looked was, that might have been my favorite thing about this show, is that they chose to do this sort of strange, cartoony sort of depiction of stuff that,
it was like Waking Life, but not animated exactly.
Yeah.
And it was this beautiful, sort of very dense graphic novel, painterly style. It is very beautiful and
it is
effective for this topic, I think.
Yeah. But so the whole story of Dave and the proposal and stuff is like way more involved. And it involves all of these weird details, which to me feel pulled from various romance novels and ideas of how we're told we want a man to be. Oh, he had her measurements, and so there were outfits waiting for her there. Okay, great. It's the Thomas Crown Affair. It's 50 Shades of something. There were rose petals leading into the apartment rose petals to me are always such a sort of like a media created sort of idea of how we want romance. No one really wants rose petals all over the house. Someone has to fucking pick that shit up. But, you know, The Bachelor and everything else has told us that that's the most romantic thing you can ever follow is a trail of rose petals to Dave standing there in a coconut bra, you know, doing a hula dance. This is weird. This is actually gross. If my husband was standing there in a coconut bra, I'd be like, unless you just got a gig in South Pacific where you're getting paid a lot of money, take that shit off. And but, you know, and it just like the layer upon layer.
That seems very scripted in a way that is not, I don't know.
It's a like proposal. It's a proposal.
Yes.
It's,
I was just going to say that.
Manufactured sort of thing that is fed to people, most often heterosexuals, but you know, the wedding industrial industry will eventually get us all. You know, that this is what you do and this is what romance means. And she packed every single little element of it into the story. And everyone who's been married, even if you've had the most fairy tale wedding imaginable, if you're Meghan Markle, you know, all of this shit didn't go down because a lot of it is dumb and gross. And you know, when she told this story, I thought, how did anyone believe this or not roll their eyes or question it? But at the same time, if someone's telling you this about their dead spouse who conveniently you did not actually legally marry, he has all these other details covered. He's going to get your measurements, so there's going to be outfits for you in Hawaii, but no one bothered to get a marriage license.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's sort of the brilliance of it, because that's a huge swing. That is a huge swing. And she connected for most people who, even if they question it, are not going to question it to her face or like bother looking it up because they don't want to be dicks, even if she never knows.
Until somebody did. And even when he did, and it was the guy whose name I don't remember, but the guy with that very broadcasty voice, he said he looked it up, he realized that it probably wasn't true, but he didn't want to ask any questions because he was afraid of being cast out of the group, and the group was so important to him that he wanted to remain part of it, so he stayed silent.
Shaved head guy?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Brandon, I think his name is.
Thank you.
Yeah, and eventually it really all starts falling apart for her, and this next clip, I'm just going to play it, and then I'm going to see if you can guess why I find this frustrating as a, like, fantasy con team drafter. This, I mean, it's so simple. It's so easy. Here's clip 9.
I begged her to give me something, a piece of evidence that I could go to the New York Times. I begged her, give me the name of the firefighter that carried you out that morning, the one that you were handed off to and threw you underneath that fire truck when the tower came down right on West Street. You told me that story a million times. You and that firefighter survived. Everybody else in Tanya's story had died. I begged her for the name of that firefighter, and she wouldn't give it to me. She would not give me the name of that firefighter. She wouldn't.
Would you like to guess what my objection is to this from a con standpoint?
Hit me.
If you've been living in New York for any length of time at all, you can fucking guess a name that it probably was. And then if it wasn't that, like, if you can't match it up, because, look, they're all Irish guys, pretty much.
Pete Davidson's dad? It was him, right?
Yeah, I mean, just say Flynn. Say Flynn. It's so fucking simple. Just say Brady.
Leary.
Brogan.
O'Connell.
Yes.
I'm just naming names of guys who live on my street, by the way.
So am I. Like, this is so simple. Like, even if you weren't there on 9/11, you have been in New York a while.
Yeah.
Guess some like just a random Irish last name, or Rodriguez, also safe.
Or Washington.
Yes.
Yep.
That covers it. And then if it doesn't match up, it'll be like, well, there was a lot going on and his name tag was Dusty. Like, I don't know.
And The thing is, you know, I actually said when I was watching this to my husband, I was, you know, once in a very bad car accident, a firefighter lifted me out of a car. I have no idea what this guy's name was. I couldn't even, you know, I've seen photos of the car. And so, you know, I've probably recreated some memories of it. But, you know, when you're actually like in an accident like that, you don't remember too much, right?
Yeah, but and you're in shock. And like all the other perfectly standard reasons that you could just be like, I don't know, Flynn, Boyle, something with five letters, shrug.
You could, but the thing is, you could build it into, like, one of the greatest regrets of my life is that I never got that man's name. If you're out there, please contact me. Like, you know.
Yeah.
I hope that all the con artists, potential con artists who are listening to this show, take our advice seriously, Sarah, because it's just that easy.
Well, really. That's why we're both so rich. Is because we're successful cons. My name isn't even Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, come on. Like, anyone would actually be named Eve Beatty. That's ridiculous.
This is actually the big announcement, ladies and germs. Yeah, we have one more clip from this, which definitely speaks to the emotional Munchausen's part of your theory of this. Here's clip 10.
It is true that Tanya never stole any money from she never made any money from this involvement. I don't think money was what her objective was, frankly.
Why she's done this has been, everybody wonders that. Myself, I don't know.
I think after 9/11, we all wanted to have a piece of it. I mean, I think if we're being honest with ourselves, there was a really human, strong desire to not only give back and try to help, but also to connect to it in some fundamental way.
Well, I think a lot of people use 9/11 to heal themselves. I mean, I think 9/11 became, oddly, a religion for some people. You know, it was a way to belong. It was a way to be part of something bigger than themselves.
For some people who need either some kind of identity or some kind of notoriety or visibility, this became a way. In Tanya's case, I would guess, I don't know for sure, but for her to feel needed.
I think all of that is absolutely correct. There's a journalist named Amanda in the middle there who is talking about how a lot of people tried to put hands on 9/11 who didn't have, quote, the right to it, unquote. I don't feel all that strongly about, like, the circles of allowable grief here. Like, it was an extremely traumatizing, fucked up incident that had global ripples, and you should feel however you need to feel about it. I'm not the police of it just because I was close by. But I also thought that needed a little more unpacking, and that could have turned into a whole other hour of this documentary, is the various sort of, like, competitive, like the competitive grief sometimes, and this like performative trauma at times, and particularly online sometimes, if memory serves, which it may not. It's been kind of a long time. And this this feeling of having a right to it and having a right to feelings about it, I think, is a whole other documentary, or at least part of this one, that could have been, they could have teased a little more out of that, I think, but they didn't. And and for that, at 64 minutes, it's a quite efficient look at this case. And, you know, I own it, so obviously I think pretty well of the film, but I also still sometimes, like, I'll be rewatching it like, oh, I wish he'd done X, I wish he'd done Y.
Well, I think that the biggest problem for me is really how it ends. And that it's one of those things like how the movie Unbreakable ends, where you're like, all right, we're going, we're rolling, bam. And then no one knows where Tanya is. And then here's a thing where someone saw her on the street and she shoves the camera. And it almost feels like sort of that bump at the end of the horror movie, like, oh, and there's a demon, he popped up again, yeah, we're done. Now credits roll. I'm like, okay, so Tanya was on the street. Does that mean she still lives in New York? Like, it doesn't, even in 2011, it's like easier now, but even in 2011, it wouldn't have been that hard to find someone who knows where she is now, to know, like, I assume her money is still coming from her wealthy family, but who can say something about it? Find Lupe, the person who, I guess the housekeeper who walked her imaginary dog. It's not, I mean, it definitely made me think, like, okay, well.
That annoyed me too. Like, Elia, go in the kitchen and look for bowls. No bowls, no dog. Yeah, what do you know?
But this is just like another like symptom of like this woman just like lied about everything, and it's like super weird. If she wanted a dog named Elvis, she's rich. She could. It's not like she lived in a building where they didn't let you have pets. That was a nice building.
Yeah. Go down to Bidewe, get yourself an Elvis. It's not that hard.
Yeah. There's Elvis's packing the shelters in, you know, the tri-state area, but you know, like, I think about how we could have had anything. We could have had a Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, this is where we think she is now. You know, her family says they haven't spoken to her in 5 years. The survivors say that, you know, occasionally, we said, oh, she sent an email and I didn't, like, follow up. But people like this don't go completely into hiding.
No. And apparently, the last that I could find on the Wikipedia page is that when this documentary came out and brought everything up again, she got fired from her job in Spain. But that was, I mean, that was what, 7 years ago now? So listeners, if you have any newer information or you want us to be nosy Nellies and track it down, let us know.
Yeah. Oh, I'd also say that I wish that, like, they would explain why they didn't have David Dunlap saying anything in the doc. Maybe he wasn't available. David Dunlap's the Times reporter that sort of unmasked her. But maybe he wasn't available. Maybe the Times wanted him for themselves. I mean, in 2011, I don't think the Times had a whole lot of documentary aspirations. It's not like it is now where they're doing, like, the weekly for FX and stuff like that. But still, like, that they didn't even say, well, we tried to talk to Dunlap, but he wasn't available. That missing his part of the story, and instead just hearing, you know, Tanya's friends saying things like, well, he was screaming at me on the phone. Listeners, I don't know a lot of things, but from what I know of David Dunlap, if he screams at someone on the phone, it's because they, like, fucked up his food order, not because he was working a story.
Yeah, that seems, well, I mean, you know, that's Tanya's account of it.
Yeah.
Her name's not even Tanya, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that a lot of listeners have watched this film. We'd love to hear from you about this, about Tanya, Mr. Guglielmo, if you're out there, and I'm probably mispronouncing your name. Please let us know what your process was for making this movie and why certain things are in it and certain things aren't. Understand, I like it a lot. I recommend it. But I'm also super curious about the behind the scenes parts and things that were not in it. So yeah, reach out. That's Blotter Presents on social, or email us editorial@theblotter.com. I always forget that dash. Speaking of dashing, it's probably time for us to, but first, when you're not chasing down 9/11 tragedy scammers, Eve, where can listeners find you?
Well, I'm hopeful that listeners will all go to find, you know, you and me on our newsletter, which I think we've mentioned a few times over the course of this podcast.
Once but more, it's, with feeling.
It's blotterpresents.substack.com, or if I think that this should work, if you just do bestevidence.fyi, you should be able to go straight to the subscription page that way,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I forgot that we had our little URL.
And listen, I understand if you're reluctant to subscribe right off the bat, but if you click the archives, you can go back and see what you'd be getting if you subscribed, you know, for the full package. Otherwise, you'll receive 2 issues a week. You'll always receive the issue involving this podcast, and you'll get 1 other issue of our choosing every week, but the rest of the time, you'll be missing out. I mean, it's $5 a month, you guys. That's less than, it's always coffee, right? That's less than a fancy coffee drink.
It's true. Yeah. Per month.
Or $55 for a year. That's a good deal.
It is. Yeah. Dads and grads.
Yeah.
All right, speaking of coffee, I'm really going to need to caffeinate because we got a lot of stuff coming up on The Blotter Presents, including Uncover the Village podcast, When They See Us about the Central Park Five on Netflix, the documentary 16 Shots on Showtime, and much more. You can find all of that by following The Blotter Presents on Twitter at Blotter Presents or by subscribing blotterpresents.substack.com. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. And one more time, that newsletter, blotterpresents.substack.com or bestevidence.fyi. If you like the podcast, I would love it if you could tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so that other listeners can find it. If you don't like the podcast, I'd really love it if you didn't tell a soul. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she's on Twitter at Eve B. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.